Good morning. It's wonderful to be thanked before I actually do anything, and it's something I recommend. Thank you so much for having me. Any opportunity I have to come to Australia, I'll take it. This is my second once-in-a-lifetime trip to Australia, and I've enjoyed it greatly. But I have to say, the last time I was here, I believe, was 2007. And in 2007, it was very different. Well, first of all, in Melbourne, it was very different. I think you folks are actually in the crane business, looking at all the construction going on. It's pretty incredible. But it's also different because of these. You know, in those days, you would get there, you'd fly in, you'd hope desperately that your airport had some sort of Wi-Fi so that once a day you might be able to check in and assure your relatives that you are still alive. Now you get off the plane and for $40, you get a SIM card that turns this phone as if it were, not only as if it were home, but you guys have like really cheap telecom. I can make international phone calls unlimited for this. I just started calling relatives for fun. For the fact that, yes, it's 3 a.m. there, I don't care. I want to tell you about what's going on. That's what I did. It was very exciting. But it makes the world very sort of small place. And so incredibly, it changes how you're doing it. And one thing it allows you to do brilliantly, particularly once again, when your family is back in the northeast of the United States where there are blizzard conditions, is that you can walk around and send them pictures like this. And so, I mean, I was just sitting there going, you know, oh, the blizzard, it's going to be horrible, it's going to be terrible, and then I just put that in the comments of Facebook, and you know, it's a good thing they added the middle finger and poop emojis, because I got a lot of those coming back at me. Also want to talk briefly, though, about process, because it's all about process of putting the presentation, and just to sort of terrify the organizers, I was walking through the gardens. It was beautiful, the Botanical Gardens and Victoria Gardens and the King's Gardens, and everyone's got a garden. It's lovely. And as I was going through there, I was trying to think about what am I going to say tomorrow, right? So it's sort of terrifying because you get a sense of when the slides were put together. But really, it's better that way. If I were presenting the same slides as I did like a year ago, I'd be, and this is true, right? No. So I'm sitting here and I'm sort of working on it, and I decided once again to bother my wife. And so we had a text conversation. And through the miracle of technology, I'm going to now recreate that conversation for you. So, for those of you who, there you go. And as always, my wife is right. I just want to say that because, one, this is being webcast and she may be checking in. But it's true that, so this is the beginning for you of the Vala Conference. It's the beginning of a new year in librarianship. It's the beginning of a new year. For me, this is an ending. This is an end to a world tour I put together. And the world tour is wonderful. It's taken me all through the Americas and up through Canada. I've done speaking down in Brazil. I've gone to the UK. I've gone through Italy. I've gone through Belgium. I've gone to New Zealand. New Zealand was fun. I don't want to put you guys on the spot, but after those keynotes, the entire audience gets up and sings to you. So it's just very odd because you're just sitting there and people are singing to you. Anyway, and so... So you learned a lot. And as I was going there, a couple of things really struck me, which is not all is well in the world. And so before we jump into that, because that's really what I want to talk about, is the responsibility and role of libraries, and particularly librarians, in the fact that not is all well in the world. But to begin with that, I need to start with just some basic concepts ahead of time. And I'm going to start with the power of words. Words matter. Words matter. The terminology that we use, the words that we choose, how we put them in, they matter. For example, if I could get a show of hands, how many libraries are in the audience today? You lie, you lie, you lie. You do not look like buildings. You do not have shelves. You can't lock your door at night, right? Libraries are either abstract organizations or they're buildings. They exert gravity and shield us from the rain. And yet, isn't it amazing that whenever we put out a press release, whenever we talk about the good we do, whenever we do advocacy, for some reason, we always give credit to the mortar and the bricks and not the people that are doing things. Well, the library is doing new reading programs. Oh, you should see the library's research service. What libraries do for faculty is amazing. You don't take credit. The royal we, even if we are in a former colony, needs to go away. We need to begin to advocate for ourselves, because what we find out is when you constantly give credit and attribute things to a library, people begin to say, why do we need librarians? We see this in schools all the time. Oh, don't worry, we fired the school librarian, but it's okay, we still have a library. No, you have a very nice closet of books, right? Oh, it's okay, our council is running out of money, we're going to be tightening our budget, it's okay, we'll get volunteers to run the library. Really, at that point, it's gardening with paper, right? This idea that if we constantly attribute the power to the building and the abstractions and not the professionals, not the agency, not the people that are doing it, then we constantly devalue ourselves. Words matter. We see this in the UK. We'll talk about that in a moment. But here's another one I want to get you. What we call them. And you know who them are. I don't know how the grammar works out. You're going to have to hit me at one point. But the them are them that come into our libraries, right? What do we call them? What do we call the folks who utilize our service, who we seek to improve and make sense? Do we call them users? Do we call them customers, consumers, members, allies, students? What do we call them? Now, I've noticed, for example, in the U.S., we tend to use the word patron a lot. We need to stop being patronizing to our service populations and start being energized by them. And I've noticed here, it's client. Client gets used a lot, which I think is delightful. Client, it's very quaint. It's like they give us money and you're like, anyway. The two terms that I want you to strike out of your vocabulary very soon is, we'll start with user. Now, there are people that I really respect that use this term and believe in this term, and it's an important term, and they mean it from the best possible way. But the problem is that user, if you think about it, constantly gets to the idea that someone is using you. Now, once again, this may be a language issue, but in America, when you get used, it's not a good thing, right? Or worse, you use someone else. You're a user, right? And then there's the old joke that only drug dealers and computer scientists have users. But this idea that who wants to be, and worse, consumer. Who wants to be consumed, right? I mean, some days we feel like we're being consumed by, you know, thumb drives and stupid requests and bathroom cleanup. But the idea of being consumed really sets this agenda. It's the idea that somehow the communities that we serve, the people that we work with, they solely are there to take things in. And it begins to negate the possibility of them producing, them sharing. Now, in academics, we think, no, we help them produce research. So why do you call them consumers? But also, as we're going to talk about in public settings and in school settings, when we look at things like 3D printing, when we look at instruction, are we truly preparing people to be good consumers, to sit and take what's given to them? Or are we really looking for people to produce and change and build societies and communities and opportunities? So what we call them is important. And I'm going to use the word member. Now, I might slip up every so often and call it patron and client because I still think it's quaint. But this idea of being a member of the library, because a member is a privilege. You're part of something. You have ownership in it. This comes from Joan Fry Williams, who, as part of a strategic planning conference, they were sitting and having deep discussions. And they said, what are we going to call them? And she said, I have this radical idea. And she stood up and she walked into the library and said, hi, what are you? And by and large, they said, I'm a member. I have a card, right? And a jacket, but that was the 1980s. But this idea of a member.
Now, what we call them amongst ourselves, that's important. But what we call them to their face, what we call our service population, what we call our members, that's a community decision, and that should be as varied as our communities. I love the idea, for example, Radical, calling people students when they're students, calling them faculty when they're faculty. In Italy, there is a wonderful library where they bring lots of people, and they call them allies. In Dallas Public Library, they talk about their neighbors because they're neighbors. So what do folks want to be called is one thing, but amongst ourselves, let us be very careful about the language that we use and what that implies. The other word I'm going to use a lot is communities. Now, many people said, oh great, it's another public library talk. No. I talk about librarianship, and librarianship spans many different domains, and community is a term where people come together around a known variable and they determine how to utilize scarce resources. Maybe that's tuition dollars. Maybe that's overhead money. Maybe it's tax dollars. Maybe it's time. Maybe it's space and location. A university is a community of faculty and students and administrators. A public library is a community of parents and workers and children and learners. A school is of students and teachers, custodians and principals. So I'm going to use the word community a lot, and what I ask you not to do is to phase out and go, oh, that's just public stuff. It's not. We have communities, and we need to start seeing them as communities, as people with needs, as people where we are together and part of, and not as consumers and users. And there's one word that I want to talk about, which is when you put this all together, you create narratives. And narratives are vital and important. What is the story of your community? If I were to walk into your library, what would the story be? This is a place where researchers discover the new world. This is a place where families come to get closer together. This is a place where students learn to achieve. What is your story? What is your narrative? The power of story, it's built into us. It's genetic. It's how we learn through conversation and discussion. And it's how people begin to identify and relate things. How do I make sense of what's happening? I tell a story. Now, we know this. We know this, that these stories are social constructs. People come together and build a story collaboratively. We know this because as a social scientist, we hate it. We hate the idea that people tell stories. And you want to know why? Because there's something called recall bias. So if I were to ask you, hey, what did you do before you came here this morning? You could tell me. And it would sound a lot like, I got up, I got dressed, I got something to eat. This is Melbourne, so you probably rode a bike somewhere, and then I came here, right? But the trick is, you will tell a story that makes sense, not necessarily a story that is the truth. It's true. Whenever you ask, it's like going up to someone, you've all had this at a desk or some experience, someone comes up and they have a question. Yes, I can't find this book. Well, what have you tried? Well, I searched the computers, of course, and then I walked over and looked for them, and I did many, many other intelligent things before I came to you. When in fact, what they did is they said, I have no idea how to use this computer, I don't know where this book is, hey, look, they're wearing a tie, I'll go there. We want to sound like rational human beings, so we make up stories. And that point is that they sound good. We teach each other. We like to think it's true. But oftentimes, they're constructed. We make them up. And I'll give you an example. You're wondering why there's a jellyfish on the screen. Australia has a reputation around the world. I don't know if I'm breaking this to you. Right? And it always begins with, crikey! Right? I, honest to God, have never heard anyone in this country say, crikey! It hasn't happened. But we're convinced that, you know, in essence, you know, Australia was a bunch of prisoners who got stuck here by the British and they turned it into a party. And I told this, by the way, my wife has relatives here, they're Italian, and I said that joke, and they looked at me and go, well, we think other immigrants had something to do with it, too. It's like, okay. An indigenous population, something. Anyway. This is the story, though. The story, of course, is Australia has the deadliest creatures on the planet, right? I mean, we can talk about, yes, sun, and things will eat you. You have a snail that can poison people. You have a snail that can poison people. Let me say that. You have a snail that can poison people. Right? I mean, mind you, not terribly terrifying when running away is not that tough. But, right? So, and you know, you go, I went to Cannes, and it was like, don't swim. It's like, but there's a beautiful ocean. No, jellyfish. It's like, oh, pretty, pretty. No, jellyfish, bad. Right? And so if you look at this, the idea is that you're going to die. I mean, really, if you read up on Australia, as an American coming, the whole story is, see Ayers Rock, go see an opera house, and you'll probably die, right? And if you look at it, right, this is what's going to kill you. Or the crocodile is going to kill you. The seawater crocodile. Does anyone know what deadly venomous creature kills more Australians than the jellyfish? I'm sorry? A car, true. It's a honeybee. Anaphylactic shock. And by the way, this would be great, we've got honeybees too, it would be great, but the truth is what's really going to get you guys is your diet, right? Number one cause of death, cardiovascular, you have a heart attack. I'm on my way. It'll be fun. We'll join each other. So the pasties, think about it, right? So the power of narratives, we come in, we tell this story, we figure it out. We hire people to come up with marketing and messaging. And what I'm going to tell you is that libraries need to get involved in the messaging business. We need to tell stories. We not just pass them, not just collect them, not just shelve them, not just circulate them. We need to help craft the stories of our communities. And so back to my wife's point about not everything's right in the world, I would like you to reflect for a moment on the narratives that I encountered in that world tour. So, narrative number one, racial strife. Black teenager, Ferguson, Missouri, the heartland of America, flyover country, if we say it in a derogatory standpoint. Black teen shot by a white cop, left in the street for hours, the dead body bleeding. Led to protest, led to discovery that a predominantly African-American community was policed by an overwhelmingly white police force with one minority member. Ferguson explodes. Ferguson just goes crazy from rage. And the story gets played out over and over again. We hear the story, for example, that they closed the schools. They closed the schools where these children got lunch. So these children are hungry, they are home, and they are up late at night as their parents wait, listening to tear gas and rubber bullets being shot by. Months later, Baltimore. Baltimore, cops take a prisoner into custody, put him in the back of a van, do not follow policy. The man breaks his neck and dies. A population in Baltimore that is used to, at best, an antagonistic relationship with the police force explodes, largest civil, peaceful protest in the history of the Eastern Seaboard, is followed by boiling over tensions, turns into riots as the community begins to tear down shopping malls, convenience stores, burning them, looting them, destroying them. Into this world, into this racial strife, into a charged area that you can have it in America, but the truth is we know that this is not immune. This is not, Australia is not immune from this. All the countries I visited are not immune from this. Whether we talk about the immigrant culture, whether we talk about how indigenous populations interrelate, as we talk about this, we know that what goes on is, I want to be equal, and you are not. Prominence, talking about privilege, talking about racial strife. Into this story, into the Ferguson story, came Scott Bonner, who did something very simple. One day he put out a very little sign. See that itty-bitty sign? It says, stay strong, Ferguson, we are a family. In the middle of riots, as being broadcast all across the United States, all across the world as black versus white, violence, looting. That library began a new narrative. And that narrative was, we are a family and we are hurting. And that narrative, not only did they put out that sign, but they stayed open. When the National Guard was called out, when militarized police force wearing military armor, they were driving mine-resistant vehicles in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. In the midst of that, the library said, we will open tomorrow. And what did they do? They invited the teachers to come in and they taught schools in the library. When they ran out of room in the libraries, they called local churches and they began teaching schools in the local churches. And they fed them and they created education and they said, we are a family. And they broadcast to the world that Ferguson is not someplace else. Ferguson is your home and your family. Suddenly the news wasn't simply black, white, over there. It was racism. It was being beaten down. It was in your community. It was your problem. They changed the narrative. Instead of being someplace else, it was here. And it was about a family. In Baltimore, as they tore down this area, Melanie Townsend Diggs, the director of the branch library, said, tomorrow I am opening the library. And they did. And what happened is not simply the idea that there were riots and looting that happened in Baltimore. They tore down the convenience stores and the shopping areas. And as often happens in depressed and racially segregated areas, there was no good transportation to move elsewhere. So they destroyed public restrooms. They destroyed their entire access to food. They destroyed their access to diapers. They destroyed their access to the basic utilities of life. And so what did they do at the Enoch Pratt Library? They didn't just simply open to share books. They took in funds, money, and resources to buy diapers, to give out food, to create legal aid for their citizens, and to begin a dialogue. What we see here is that librarians, made a choice. During the Ferguson, someone tweeted out, libraries always make a difference. And I said, no. I said, first of all, librarians always make a difference, and they don't always make a difference. They didn't have to open. Neither of these places had to go in. In the midst of fighting and struggles, do you really think that they could have called the mayor and said, you know, I'm thinking the library could close today, and the mayor would have gone, no, 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 no. We damn well need the library. That's going to stay open. Close the schools, close the food, close the federal offices, call out the military, but the library will be open, by God. No, that's not what happened. What happened was they said, we choose to make a difference. We choose to go where there's conflict. We choose to open up and become a family. Librarians choose to make a difference. So this narrative of civil strife can be replaced by, we build diverse communities. We build communities, and diversity is important. Why? Because we've always known when people learn, when we always know when we collect, we always know when we provide services that the greatest variety of information, the most diverse sources of information, yield the greatest learning, the greatest knowledge. The same is true of our people. We can document and demonstrate and show that by bringing diversity together in a conversation from learning, we hold human libraries where you can sit down with a Muslim because you've never met with a Muslim, and you can sit down with someone who's homeless because you've only driven by before. That's what librarians can do. Next narrative. A little tension. Austerity. I heard this one a lot. This idea that, we can't do anything. Austerity budgets. Thank you, America, for ruining the economy. You're welcome. But now there's no money. We can't do it. We can't do it because they won't do it. They, meaning the government, they're out to get us. They want to cut down public services. They won't spend money on libraries. They won't spend money on librarians. They won't spend money on schools. They're cutting back. They're cutting back. They're cutting back. It hurts. It's so bad, by the way, this isn't just an EU thing. This gentleman, if you want to talk about having a bad day, he won the lottery, but he had the misfortune of winning the lottery in Illinois, a state in the United States where they have not had a budget for 8 months. Guess what he got instead of a check? An IOU. Can you imagine that? I won! Here's your IOU. What? This is how crazy this is, right? We're talking about governments that can't agree on pricing. We're talking about cutting and slashing. What we're seeing is the near destruction of the social safety net. We are seeing the days when the public library will be the last public institution standing. And what happens is we keep dumping more and more on that public library. Okay, you're going to do books and literature. Now you're going to do tax forms. Now you're going to do tech support. Now you're going to do filing for Social Security. Now you're going to do this and this and this. And librarians sit there and go, I can't do it. And we see it in academic libraries. We're cutting back, but that's all right. Tutoring can move over to the library, and the publishing can move over to the library, and everything can move over to the library, and they'll figure it out. And we haven't been immune from this in the library sector. What we're seeing in the UK is the actual closure of libraries. And we're seeing this elsewhere. We see this in the United States. We see this throughout Europe. We feel that pain. So once again, we could look at this and say, we're done. We can't fight. Or we can. We could talk about, for example, the Public Library of Toronto commissioned a study of the economic impact of the Toronto Public Library. They found for every dollar spent to fund the public library, $5.63 was returned, a five-fold delivery back. The narrative here is investment in public libraries, and by the way, in academic libraries and in school libraries, yields better results. What we can see is that it's about creating opportunity. This is the best investment that any institution can make, and we have data to show it. And by the way, for those who can't afford to get to the library, this is a program out of Cazenovia Public Library. And Cazenovia Public Library is a very, very rich city, town really, on a lake. And it's in the poorest county in all of New York State. And what they realized was they were having people going to food pantries, and families would come to food pantries, and when they were there, the kids had nothing to do. And they said, what could we do as a library? And they said, well, we'll go and we'll do reading sessions. And while they were doing story time and reading and enrichment and development, early literacy training, they realized that part of the reason the parents were there is because they didn't have access to education. They couldn't go, they couldn't afford it, they couldn't take time. So they began a high school equivalency program. They began training and teaching the parents. And once again, it happened in Cazenovia, and they shared it across, and it's shared across the entire state. Betsy Kennedy tells the story where she brought a book, and they gave out new books, right? How traditional does this get? They gave out new books to kids. Revolutionary. And as she gave out this book to this small girl, the girl started crying. And Betsy said, what's wrong? And the girl said, this is the first new thing I have ever owned. What that librarian was doing, what they chose to do, was not simply to give them a book or move them along in reading. They gave that girl worth. They gave that girl value. They said, you are important. We see this in other libraries, in maker spaces, where they're talking about creating whole new manufacturing industries. They're going around and teaching people that you don't simply consume. You can create your own business. You can create your own invention. You're not just stuck with what you can buy. You can make your own things with 3D printers and laser etchers and all this stuff. And people often go, why are we putting a 3D printer into a library? Are you going to read the manual? The answer is because people learn in all sorts of different ways. And a lot of people learn by doing something, by building something. I worked with my brother-in-law, teaches biology at a pharmaceutical college. He came in and we're sort of going through Thingiverse, if you've ever seen Thingiverse, website with lots of 3D objects. And we're going through and he suddenly sees it. Goes, stop, that one. It's an antibody. So I printed out an antibody, which looks remarkably like three globs smashed together. And he was so thrilled. He got so excited. He's like, this is awesome. And I said, it's like three globs stuck together. He says, no, he goes, and he started explaining, these are the parts that connect into the cell that activate the antibody. And he was starting to print out 3D models of protein folding, and he's bringing it in the classrooms as an example. And what he got out of that by 3D printing, by showing that manufacturing, is we can learn in whole new ways. The University of Nevada, Reno, they have an engineering library, and brilliant guy, and he works with engineering students and math students. Math students come in and they're like, I don't quite understand this concept, and you can only graph it in two dimensions. They're printing out complex three-dimensional graphing symbols so that people can suddenly feel what numbers look like. That's why we have 3D printing. So what's the narrative here? Austerity, we can't do it, we can't do it. How about we transform investment into opportunities? Isn't that a story that we can tell councils, that we can tell provosts, that we can tell faculty, that we can tell principals? You give me the resources, I will give you back fivefold what you give me in economic development, in learning, in culture, in understanding. That's a narrative that people can support and get by and get around. Next narrative, migrant crisis. As I traveled through Europe, and you would go from train station to train station, all you would see is a mass of humanity stuck. People living on the street because that's as far as they could get before their funding ran out, before they were prevented from going elsewhere. We've seen what's happened in the Mediterranean Ocean. We've seen what's happening crossing in Turkey. And the United States is hardly immune from this. We've seen this is a group of mothers from South America and Central America, making their way through Mexico. The pictures on their chest are their relatives they sent ahead and are missing and they are looking for. The migrant crisis is so bad in the United States, not because people want to come here to get our jobs, It's so bad that in Central America, driven by gangs and drug cartels, parents will send their own children alone, as young as 4 years old, desperately trying to get to America to save their lives. Gangs would literally walk into schools and take children to join their gang or kill them if they didn't. And they're so desperate. Could you imagine sending your own child alone with someone you don't know, gathering every dime you have to send them to a new land in hopes that something will happen? And that our answer apparently is we're going to build a wall. And they're going to pay for it. Thank you very much. A little comic relief brought to you by our current presidential candidate. So, and let's face it, I didn't want to bring it up. This is not immune. Australia kind of having a discussion about this as well. Right? So what do we do? What do we look at? What are librarians doing about it? Are they simply sitting back and going, I don't see it, I don't care? Or are they starting whole new services to welcome in refugees and migrants who bring them in and they provide language training and they provide literacy services and they go to music festivals and whole festivals that celebrate it. The people coming over the border are not simply people too poor to eat, they're lawyers and physicists and doctors, and they're escaping the worst conditions you can imagine. This is something that we can do something about. We can be part of a solution. Libraries reach out and say, it's not simply over there, it's us. They go into migrant camps, they bring resources, they bring materials. They set up resources on refugee systems and how to deal with migration and how to deal with these issues in the language and collect materials. This is an example where libraries make a difference. They've changed the narrative from crisis and terrorists coming across the border to people and children who need help, to new citizenship. Part of why Germany is welcoming with open arms migrants isn't simply because it's the right thing to do. They're doing it also because they realize with the shift in their population, they desperately need a younger workforce. There are economic opportunities that are being part of this, and libraries are reaching out and being part of that solution. So instead of a narrative of we have a migrant crisis, we as librarians and libraries are gateway to a cultural identity. Over and over again, I went to different places and they talked about, well, my job as a library is I'm in the cultural heritage business. I said, what does that mean? And they said, well, we have lots of cultural heritage. And I said, and what does that mean? And they said, we have really old books. At one point, someone in Italy, I love the Italians, said, oh, that Lancas community stuff, he's American, they don't have any culture, so they don't collect it. Which is true, but at the same time, the Italians are covered with culture and they can't move because of it. So this idea that cultural heritage is just our stuff. It's our language, it's our philosophy, it's our bearing, it's our values, it's our connection, it's our history, it's our future, it's our planning. And librarians are putting out a beautiful welcome mat that says, look, you came from a horrible situation. We want to make you welcome. But to succeed here, you need to be brought up into a huge dialogue. And we can make that happen. We can accelerate that process. We can be part of a solution and not simply, oh, we're worried about the homeless coming into our foyers. What if we replaced this with a cultural gateway? Nature's fury. It also turns out in this year that every so often, nature did not take a break. This is South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, where they had three lovely rivers that went through the city, not unlike here. But it turns out that massive development in the suburbs around the watershed areas, when they would build beautiful houses, the first thing they'd do would be to dam up streams and rivers to make a lake so that you could build a house near a lake and charge more money. Didn't necessarily spend much time with the engineering of said earthen dams. So when historic rains came, historic flooding, guess what happened? All the dams broke, led to a cascade effect, and created a situation where major parts of the city were underwater. The other thing I read while I go to museums, I did go to museums while here, is that congratulations on being the second driest continent. Apparently, Antarctica beat you by just that much. And I think it's cheating because they really have lots of water. It's just frozen, right? I mean, so you're number one. Well, we have this state, it's called California, and it is lovely. And it is dry. Until El Nino, now it's, of course, mudslides. But we had this situation, nature's fury. We have these things called hurricanes every so often that completely wipe out different parts of our coastal environment. And by the way, it's not like climate change is causing it, because we know from our politicians, there's no such thing. Right? So we have this situation. What can libraries do in the face of a hurricane? What can libraries do in the face of a drought? What are librarians supposed to do about flooding? A lot. For example, in South Carolina, FEMA set up all of their response and emergency, Federal Emergency Management Administration. All their relief work, all the federal aid came out of the public libraries. That's where they set up. People were used to and they went to, that's where they went to for support. In New York, with Hurricane Sandy several years ago, as this massive storm went up the eastern seaboard and it wiped out home and neighborhood after neighborhood, including into parts of New York City and Manhattan that were flooded out. What did the librarians do? Librarians who, by the way, lost their own homes and their own settings and their own world, what did they do? They sprang open the doors. And this is the librarians in the Queens Public Library giving out coats and blankets. This is another library that opened because, guess what? When you're in a flooded situation these days, this is your lifeline. They set out not to read and distract, but to charge up devices so they could call relatives and say, yes, I'm still alive. Yes, I'm here. Yes, I matter. They provided food and shelter. They took bookmobiles and brought clean water from place to place to place. When librarians saw crisis, when librarians saw hopelessness, when librarians saw their own worlds disappear, they stepped up to make a difference. They put forward a narrative that we are there in a crisis. When you need us, we are there. We have a new narrative that we have to figure out what to do with. It's this one. This is not a new idea, but it certainly became much more important this year. Certainly much more profit. We have a situation where security is the problem. Where terrorism strikes, this is where it struck twice in France. But if you'd like, there's a huge list of where it struck in Egypt, where it struck in Russia, where it struck even shootings in Australia. We see terrorism, we see fear. We see non-state actors taking large plants and they're coming for us and we have to take care of it. And what is the response that comes out again and again from our governments? Surveillance, security, protection. We need emergency powers. We need to be able to read your emails. We need to look at your metadata. We need to see what transactions are occurring. It's okay, we do it because we want to protect you. We have a narrative that says that you live in a dangerous world, and the response to living in a dangerous world is to give up your liberties, to give up your rights of privacy, to give up your rights of congregating in groups, of speaking, of dissension. We want to know what's happening, and guess where they knock? They knock on our doors and say, we want to know what people are reading. We want to see what they're doing. Is this a narrative that we believe? Is this a narrative that as librarians we want to put forward? Is this a narrative that we want to let stand? Because it's winning and it's out there. If we truly believe that a library mediated, curated, created by librarians is a safe place to access dangerous ideas, we cannot let this narrative stand. We must put forth an alternative narrative that says security comes not through limiting freedom, but stronger, inclusive communities where neighbor knows and respects a neighbor. I work in a university. I work next to Muslims and Hindus and Christians and Jews and probably a few Wiccans and witches, and I have no idea what else. And it doesn't matter one whit. It doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter what community it is. It doesn't matter if you're from India or China or the United States or Australia, because we're all there to learn. And we all know that when we learn, when we have an education, when we have knowledge, we can do things and have opportunities that never were available to us before. And that is too precious and too important to put on hold just in case. That narrative we must talk about, because librarians knit these communities together. We don't simply happen. It's not simply because libraries are there that it will happen. It takes work. It takes a choice. It takes part of what we do. What we must understand is that as librarians, we must talk about being a noble profession. Now, this conference, as most conferences will be a lot about the hows. How do I do this? How do I do that? And the what's. What is this standard? What is this system? What is this software? What can it do? But what must be part of every conversation that you have over this week, and every conversation when you go back, is the whys. Why do we do this? Why do we collect books? Why do we collect databases? Why do we license resources? Why do we teach? Why do we open the doors? Why do we provide a space to begin with? Because it's only in the whys that we look in truly becoming a noble profession. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have been accused of being a library cheerleader in my life. I guess the literary term would be an apologist, right? I believe in the value of librarians. I believe that librarians are noble. I believe in the great things we've done. But if all you take away from today, if all you do is walk away and say, wasn't that great? Oh, it's good to be a librarian. We help people when they're in trouble. Oh, it's great to be a librarian. We're there in times of crisis. If all you do is walk away and feel good about your profession, but don't do anything about it, then you have not gotten the message. The message is we are a noble profession, but only when we do all of these things. Only when we build diverse communities, not allow them to happen about us, not serve them, not look for a community as a consumer that we pile data and books and reading into. That's not how this works. It only happens that we talk about our nobility and our importance, and it only happens when we build diverse communities, active verb and out there. We transform investment into opportunity. It doesn't happen by magic. I can point to libraries to get plenty of tuition dollars. I can point to libraries, they get plenty of tax dollars, and frankly, all they do is deposit the check. It's not about do they walk in or not? It takes courage. It takes work. It takes putting yourself out there. It takes standing up and saying, I am important not because I say I'm important. I'm important because I do important things. We serve all, not the people who walk into our buildings, Not the people who know about us, not the people who take the time to cart. We serve all. If you lie sleeping homeless, you are part of my library. If you are a professor and you have said things that angered the world, you are in my library. You are my community. We are members together. We serve all by race, by gender identity. We serve all by ethnicity. We serve all by localities. We serve all. That takes courage. It takes opening the doors and you leaving the building. It takes the idea that your true collection is not the materials and the books that you buy or license, but the communities that you serve. Think about that for a moment. Think about everything that's on your shelves. And rather than looking at that as knowledge and what your job is, think of them as tools. Those books, those spines, those databases, those licenses, hammers, chisels, pliers. And what do those tools do? They make our communities smarter. They make our communities better. But just as a hammer does nothing unless it has a hand to pick it up, those tools, those books, those databases, that building, that material, does nothing unless you pick it up. When was the last time that you went out to a faculty meeting? When was the last time you went out to a football game and brought a wireless hotspot? When was the last time you sat in a classroom just to hear what was happening? When was the last time you left the building? Because guess what? That building is a tool. It's a great tool. It's a resource. And it's probably really good looking with steel if it's been built in the last 10 years. But it's just a tool. Barbara Quint once talked about a library after hours is like a coral reef without the fish. Beautiful. But dead. That building, those materials, that desk, whatever it is, it's a coral reef. It takes the buzzing of members and librarians and authors and parents and crazy people to come in and make it a reality and make it an opportunity. We serve all and we are there in a crisis. And ladies and gentlemen, we are in a crisis. We are in a crisis of race. We are in a crisis of immigration. We are in a crisis of nature's fury and climate change. We are in crises after crises after crises. And our communities desperately need us. We are in a crisis where people can discount science and say belief is enough. We are in a society that all too often accepts loud people as important and not smart people as important. We must spend that crisis. We must be there. We must be available. This is when they need us. Librarians must knit together these communities. They must be part of what we do. Ladies and gentlemen, if you walk out of here today believing solely that, oh, it's great to be a librarian. We do cool stuff. Oh, we start entrepreneurs. Oh, we have a makerspace. It's neat. It's cool. It's keen. Then you didn't get the message. The message, the challenge for you, the challenge for you at this conference is to expect more. It's to expect more, and now I do a lot of talking about how our communities need to come up to speed and our communities need to learn, and they need to expect more out of libraries. Today, it's all about you. If you take pride in these stories, but no action, then librarianship and communities need to expect more from you. If you seek to document the world and inform it, not change it and improve it, then librarianship and communities need to expect more of you. If you believe you're in the book business, then librarianship and your communities need to expect a lot more from you. If you are in the book business, if we're in the book business, we suck at it. I mean, think about it for a moment. What if we take beautiful books, we cover them in plastic, we put stickers on them, and we let people take them home where they can eat and drink near them. That's not book business. That's learning business. Learning is a messy, terribly coffee-infused activity that should be about destruction and trying new things and being dirty and doing all these new things. Those books, tools. Every time someone says, oh, you're a librarian, you must love to read. Just say yes. I love to swim too, and I don't have time to do that at the library either. Becoming a librarian because you love books is like becoming a cop because you love guns. It's not a good idea. And hopefully you won't use them that much. This idea, we're all about sort of learning. If you take a wait-and-see approach, if you believe somehow that magic will occur, and because you're a librarian, people love you, you earn that. We earn the trust of our communities. So here's my summative comment. Here's where we end. This is my last world tour speech, and then I get to retreat for a while and think up new stuff, hopefully. So my last message to you is, yes, our community should expect more of ourselves. One of the comments I often get back is, Dave, we want to do that. We want to do cool stuff. We want to do neat things, but they won't let us. What do you mean they won't let us? The communities, they have this image of us from 1932. Right? It's like they love books and they love places and it's quiet. Say, all right, that's a problem. John Palfrey, who wrote a great book called Bibliotech, calls it nostalgia. We need a new nostalgia. The old one is of things that were in the 1950s and 1960s and the bookmobiles and such. We need to introduce a new nostalgia where the library is a place of learning, engagement, excitement. Small library outside of New York during the sort of, we have what's called the summer break. I imagine you have the different months, right? And all the students are home. And in America, one of the major issues that occurs is gender and the sciences. That what happens is, if you poll children at like grades 3, grades 4, and you ask them, what do you want to be when you grow up? Boys and girls will pretty much say, I want to be a scientist, I want to be a chemist, at equal numbers. Right? If you then go up into high school, into secondary school, and you ask boys and girls, boys will, in a large number, not actually smaller from that original, say, scientists, girls will go down to really tiny numbers. Somewhere, education beats the science out of girls. And a library looked at this, and rather than saying, a public library, rather than saying, oh, that's the school's problem, oh, that's not our problem, they said, we're going to do something about this. Our community said this is a problem. We're going to be part of it. And the answer wasn't, we'll buy more girl science books. The answer was, we're going to have Geek Girl Summer Camp. And what they did is they brought in girls. By the way, all the parents with boys were really pissed off. But they brought in all these girls, and they, for a week, they did things like build. They built trebuchets, and they built catapults in the library. And so at one point, like, you know, little old ladies were walking with books, and like things were flying over their head. And they brought in engineers. They brought in a fighter pilot. They brought in a female fighter pilot who could talk about what it was like to be in the military, what it was like to be a fighter pilot, what it was like to be a mom, what it was like to be a woman going through education. And what's amazing about this story is that fighter pilot and those engineers live in the same community as those girls. So when that summer camp is done, they have a connection. They can talk to each other. What they were doing was collection development, right? They were taking care of the most important collection, which wasn't the girls, sorry, which wasn't the books and the materials, or by the way, non-Newtonian fluids, which is a whole other world. But it was the community, it was the girls, and it was the teachers and the engineers. That was their collection. That was the power that they had that no book or material could have ever done. I don't hate books. I use books. And there, by the way, user of books, that's what I do. I don't use my library, I'm part of my library. I talk about how I can inform, how I can be a part of it. This is what we can do. This week is your chance. If you haven't done it already, this is the week to do it. This is the week to say, I am going to be part of a noble profession. I am going to expect more of myself. This week, in every session you go, my challenge to you is to not sit back. My challenge to you is not to simply consume and write down and say, I can do it, but to ask yourself, why and why not? Why do we do this? Why should I invest in this? Why should I spend any second on something other than working with my community? And why not? Why not start a new program? Why not take wireless hotspots? Why not go to that faculty meeting? Why not start a new system? Why not? Break from your nostalgia. Break from your concepts. And you can do it. That world tour that I started, that world tour started because in 2 weeks I'm having my second birthday. Now I know, I look really good for my age. Obvious joke about what the mother had to go through here now. 2 years ago, I checked into the hospital. 2 years ago, the doctors administered lethal chemotherapy to kill a blood cancer. And they killed the cancer. And in the process, they also killed all my bone marrow. 2 years ago, those doctors re-injected me with stem cells that hopefully would find their way into my bone marrow. And for 2 weeks after that, I lay in a hospital bed where literally a common cold could have killed me. And then I had to leave. And my world consisted of the hospital. And then it consisted of the hospital in my home. And then, slowly, I was able to go back to work over that year. Imagine going to work where your coworkers could kill you. I wasn't able to be near soldiers because American soldiers going off in deployments get a smallpox vaccine, which is a live virus. And I didn't want smallpox. For that year, I slowly opened up and I slowly regained strength and I slowly moved forward. And I didn't have a choice. But you know what happened? 1 year later, 1 year after that injection, the doctors gave me my vaccinations as a child, and they said, now you can travel. And I took a flight to Springfield, Illinois. And there's nothing, by the way, more exciting than when you get on an airplane and you sit next to a guy with a mask and, like, gloves and disinfectant. It's like, pardon me, just wipe them down for a moment. I said to the doctor, I said, does the mask really help? They go, no, but people won't get near you, and that's what you want. And I was able to go from that one trip to Springfield to then I could start going to other places, and so I took a trip to Massachusetts, and I was able to go to Toronto. And that world tour this past year has been about, suddenly I have the ability, and I'm going to England, and I'm coming to Australia, and I'm in New Zealand, and I'm going around the world. So while I did not have a choice about having a birthday 2 years ago, I had every choice about what to do 1 year later. And my choice was to come here. And my choice was to talk to you. And my choice was to push librarianship harder than I ever did. And the reason I make that choice, and the reason I come here, and the reason I believe in you, and the reason that I get power from you, and the reason that you are important is because you can inspire a global change. What you can do starting this week, starting today, is you can make libraries more important than ever. You can make librarians more important than ever, and you can push forward, and you can change whole communities so that when these narratives of negativity and austerity and crises come up, you can say, I'm a librarian, and I save the world on a regular basis. That's my challenge to you this week. Thank you very much.